Well, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon with you, Steve. Perhaps we could start by asking you to give us your name and then describe how you came to work in the grain industry.
Okay, I'd be more than pleased to do that. My name is Steven Sidorsky. I've lived all my life in Thunder Bay, born here in 1950, and always wondered what those big gray things on the waterfront were all about, eh? I spent lots of time in my youth, because I lived on Cumberland Street in Thunder Bay, going down to the waterfront, chasing with my buddies, we were crossing the tracks and chasing pigeons and just carrying around, fooling around. But you would always do it on the weekend, and the elevators were always shut and nothing was happening. So I pursued my education, went to Lakeview High School, which overlooked Curt River Elevators. And I used to daydream out the window looking at them again, wondering what they were all about, and seeing all those big clouds of dust coming out of them and boats coming in and all those, I guess, either exciting or non-exciting things happening. My first summer job was actually through my uncle, who was more or less a mechanical superintendent for Canada Malting, which is one of the elevators in Thunder Bay. He lived in Winnipeg, and we would spend most of our time because my mom was very close to him, traveling to Winnipeg to visit him in the summertime, and him coming back and visiting us. And so when I looked for my first job when I was 16, he recommended or offered me a chance to work at Canada Malting in Thunder Bay. And I took that opportunity working there in the summertime for 3 years, 16, 17, and 18, for the summertime while I was going to high school. It was different, challenging work, very hard work. I was involved in very mechanical stuff there, which was shoveling boxcars out using a board, bagging their malting house. So they bag up malt there, and you carry 110-pound bags of malt and load them in boxcars. So basically, it was very mechanical and not really something that I thought that I was going to pursue the rest of my life doing. However, I did enjoy it, and number one, the pay was good. After I graduated from high school, I came to Lakeview University here and continued working at another plant. At that time, it was called McCabe's Grain Elevator. It was in the process of being sold at that time, so that would be roughly around 1970 to 73, was in the process of being sold to United Grain Growers, which was taking over a couple of the plants in Thunder Bay. I worked there again, driving a little different trade there. I was driving a bobcat, which was on an elevated platform. It was an electrical bobcat, very fast moving. They were used to unload the boxcars there. So you would break down the door with the bobcat, go in, empty out the contents, get inside the boxcar. Very dusty, dirty, hot job. And seasonal work again, because I was going to university at the time. 1973, I took a break. I had graduated and was offered a position with Revenue Canada in Vancouver. Went there for approximately a year. Decided at that time that I wanted to come back home. My mom was, my father had passed away, and my mom was not in the best of health, and so came back to Thunder Bay. I was offered two or three different positions because I worked for the government, federal government at the time in British Columbia. I was offered a job with the Canadian Grain Commission here, the RCMP locally here, and also with Revenue Canada. So I decided the RCMP was maybe not what I wanted to do. It involved a lot of chance for relocation. That's why I was coming back to Thunder Bay. And so I basically decided that the best thing for me at the time was to join the Canadian Grain Commission as an assistant inspector, which I did in 1976. And has since then progressed through the ranks and been with them for almost 34 years. Oh, actually 34 years on February the 13th, my 34th year finished. So I've seen many changes over the years in the grain trade and many different exciting things happening. The biggest event for, I guess, everybody in Thunder Bay was the change of losing Russia as one of our big customers, and that involved a big switch in the grain movement from 60% to 70% of it going east to now 60 to 70% of it going west. and with that, the downsizing over the years in Thunder Bay.
When did that occur? This
early 1980, 81 time frame. Russia at the time was undergoing changes and breaking up itself, and they owed us at the time over $600 million for grain that we had shipped to them over the years. Basically, everything pretty well went to Russia. That was our biggest customer out of Thunder Bay, and that was a devastating hit for the not only for the grain elevator companies, but for also a lot of men that worked in the industry. At the same time, mixed with that was the technological computer change that was going about, and that also resulted in a huge downsizing of jobs because everything was becoming more, I guess you could say, computer run.
Yes. Was there any sense of political factors being involved in the Russian disappearance from the market?
From my perspective, not so much in Canada that would affect us here. I think that in Russia, I think it was more or less with the breakup of the country, the economy was suffering. They just didn't have the money, it seemed, at the time, if I recollect.
The collapse of the Soviet Union is circa 1990, isn't it? So and this is, you're describing 81 or 2. So it must have been economic difficulties in Russia itself. They didn't have the foreign exchange, perhaps, to keep up, continue buying from Canada the way they had. Well, that's been a great sketch you've given us of your career already. To go back to those summer jobs for just a few moments, the work that you did at Canada Malting and cleaning and unloading the grain and then loading the malting afterwards was all, as you were saying, pretty mechanical. It was physical labor that you were carrying out. There really wasn't much in the way of equipment there at all through those years.
No, it was a self-contained plant. They're Canada Malting is basically a company that more or less deal in barley, and they were not really under the Canadian Grain Commission or the Canadian Wheat Board. We oversaw some of the later years. We oversaw their shipments of grain barley out if they did that, but usually they processed it in Thunder Bay. They processed it from a barley into a malt, and they sold the malt to. They had their own buyers, et cetera. So,
what is malt? What's done to the barley to turn it into malt?
It's heated, and the barley turns from a starch into a sugar, but through the heating process. Actually, they were one of the big reasons that natural gas came to Thunder Bay, because of the amount of gas that they use to heat the
amount of heat that they needed.
Yeah, to heat the barley and dry it out. Turn it almost into from a starch to a sugar is an unbelievable, like the whole process I'm not 100% aware of. But and then what they do is they just, I guess, more or less pulverize the barley kernel into a like almost a flour, and add ingredients to it, and that the malt is used in production of one of the ingredients in the production of beer, as we all know.
Yes, the stuff in the bags.
Our substance that they would load off, put it into cargo bags of
110 pounds.
110 pounds. Load them in boxcars. It was one way. Other ways that they would load it out, they would load it on board ships, foreign ships.
How large is a malting a bag of malt at 110 pounds?
Can you pick
it up easily?
What we would do is we would load them. In a certain part of the upstairs facility in Canada Malting, sew the bag shut, put it down a conveyor belt into the boxcar. If you were in the boxcar, you would stop it coming off the conveyor belt, load it on your shoulder, and then just stack them up. So it was more or less very mechanical.
Sure, physical work. I have quite keen memories of unloading Portland cement bags at 87.5 pounds. I don't know that they were much more than... Here I am going Imperial. Would they be 15 to 18 inches? Oh, maybe. Yeah, something like that. It's astonishing, depending a little bit on the bulk of it. But still, it's 110 pounds. Yeah. And if you had any quantity of that to handle, you'd be nice and tired.
We were nice and tired.
End of the day, no doubt. Yeah. And then the McCabe elevators. In both cases, the boxcars. They came in, the grain came in boxcars.
Yes.
And wooden boxcars, I guess. And so the unloading was fairly straightforward in one sense. And the Bobcat, of course, was a great advance on what you had to do in
Canada. Oh, for sure, yeah.
Canada Malton.
There was, yeah, and there was also different, depending on what plant you worked at, had different devices for unloading. At McCabe's, they used to unload by using the board. And they went to the, they found the most cheapest way for them to change from using the board to make it more user-friendly for the person unloading would be to go to the Bobcat.
Yeah.
Other plants went into dumpers. Most of the mechanical dumpers.
These are really where they
picked the car up
the
and
car
tilted
or
either
whatever.
Way. And that era was the advent of the tanker car,
yes.
Where they would unload the bottom of the tanker. The tanker increased the amount of capacity that they could bring here per car from approximately 60 metric tons to 90 metric tons would be the average tanker. Very easy to unload. They would have initially they would have men with bars unloading a slide at the bottom of the tanker, 10 feet out into a hopper. Now it's done by a mechanical device that attaches to that hopper opener and opens it automatically. So
less and less muscle work. And
a lot less.
Less
initially at one of the bigger plants here, Sasquatchpool, they would have roughly 40 men per shift unloading approximately 110 to 120 boxcars of grain. That is down to 110 or 115 tankers of grain with 3 to 5 men doing that.
Yes.
So it's a huge change.
Enormous reduction in labor.
In the labor.
And that was happening already in the...
That was happening. The invention of the tanker in Thunder Bay. And I'm thinking that was about the same time, in the early 80s. It was like a 10-year cycle there from the early 80s to the very early 90s that it switched over completely to taking boxcars out of service and putting tankers in.
Because some of this was, I guess, economic development money.
Mm-hmm,
many
was.
Of those cars were built where in Cape Breton, in Nova Scotia, federal funding. And then, of course, the provinces were involved. And every resident of Thunder Bay has seen those copper cars with various logos on them, names indicating who owns these cars.
Very conducive to Thunder Bay because when you come from the prairies here, it's strictly downhill. So,
yes.
You know, two engines can haul 70 to 90 cars downhill, no problem at all,
right.
At a high rate of speed, so that's a lot more volume coming here,
yes.
A lot less expense to the railroad, and then when they go back light, so you can haul 90 cars back with a couple locomotives. Different story out west, that they got to go through the Rogers Pass there.
Yes, and of course in the late 80s, CP through the mountain, tunneled through the mountain in order to make it easier to carry the grain and move the trains through that area. Well, the moving from after the year with Revenue Canada, coming back to the Grain Commission, was quite a significant change in the work that you did. You weren't involved in any of that brute labor any longer. Back to the McCabe, actually, for a moment. You mentioned an electric Bobcat. I guess it would not be advisable to have a gasoline or whatever powered Bobcat working in those cars and all the dust.
Because even though for a third of the time while you're unloading the actual boxcar, you're on an elevated grate platform, very narrow, in the air at the level of the bottom of the door of the boxcar.
Yes.
So once you get the door open and you can get the box of the Bobcat into the boxcar, now you have to unload both ends of it. So you would be in there with diesel fumes, et cetera, gas fumes, considering all the dust that was in there already. I can remember the days that I would go in there, and after doing one car, your mask and goggles, you couldn't see out your goggles. In fact, most of the time, you were unloading blind because you were causing so much dust from the grain that you were handling in there. It was so dirty coming from the prairies, you couldn't see what you were doing anyways. It was more or less just knowing what you were doing inside the vehicle in the boxcar yourself.
Was the dust inevitable? Was all grain, did all grain produce dust? I'm a farmer's son, so when you talk about dirty grain, I get a little defensive immediately, but was it all dusty?
Oh yeah,
fairly
dust.
Uniformly?
And in that dust, there's a huge amount of insecticides at the time, different natural occurring fungicides in the grain. All of that was was not necessarily cleaned out by the early combines that they had.
No.
So basically, farmers would just clean the fields, dockage the excess straw and stuff was knocked out, but they would ship it here dirty. There was no cleaning elevators on the prairies.
Ask of the turbo elevators here to clean that grain.
To clean the grain and ship it, right. Prepared for shipping, yes. Either domestically or overseas. Yeah.
When you began working for the Grain Commission, were there typical days? Was there a rhythm to the day that you could describe?
Well, initially when we started, it was the early stages of the process here, and there was a lot of mechanical stuff involved. So my day would be, as an assistant, I would either be collecting information from the tankers or boxcars to process into the system, helping inspectors clean and prepare the grain for grading. I would spend a lot of time initially working on boat sampling by hand. We would use a handheld device to sample from the big spouts that load the grain into the different vessels. We would also do hand sampling for cars that we loaded out if we were shipping them to. We also did a lot of sampling in the car shed. The sampling system was set up to collect a sample automatically, but it wouldn't. There was no pneumatic system to bring it into our offices, so we would more or less do that kind of rudimentary.
Running it back and forth.
Yeah, running back and forth and doing jobs, different jobs. Depending on the plant, too, if they were a little more ahead of the times or if they were financially more viable, they were moving forward with more new techniques, etc.
And this was the work that you did at whichever elevator you were sent to?
Whatever site. And there was many sites at the time, too. There was... In Current River, there was United Grain Growers A, there was Pool 4A, which was Saskatchewan Pool 4A, and Saskatchewan Pool 4B. There was also JRI had a big plant, which James Richardson's Terminals.
Yeah.
At downtown Port Arthur was Sask Wheat Pool 6 had a plant. There were half a dozen plants at InterCity, starting with. Manitoba Elevator 7B, Saskatchewan Elevator 7A, which were sisters. Beside that was United Grain Growers M Elevator, which was McCabe's formerly. And beside that was Manitoba Pool Elevator 1. And then a small little elevator called Parrish and Heimbecker. At Chippewa area, there was two elevators at the time, Sasquatch Pool 5, which became 15, and Cargo, which is an American company, had a plant there also.
Right.
On the river, there was three or four elevators. There was Patterson, had a small plant there. Saskatchewan Wheat Pool had an elevator 5A and E there, and Western Grain had a plant at the time there. So there was quite a few elevators for quite a while, mm-hmm. Until the early 80s when we started to lose Russia. Yeah. These plants all started to shut down.
Well, I have keen memories of Patterson's coming down in the summer of 78 as I was moving to town.
Yeah.
That was a painful thing to see. My father later that had handled it all those years was gone. If we were to take the grain in one boxcar, how, and just sort of follow it through, how often, at how many stages would that grain be sampled?
Well, it would be sampled, initially it would be sampled when it was loaded out west at the country elevator.
Right.
The elevator manager or his assistant would take a sample of the grain as they were loading it into that particular boxcar for its destination to Thunder Bay or wherever it was going, Vancouver or even Montreal, Quebec City if it was bypassing Thunder Bay, which very seldom it did. And then it would be sampled and unload in Thunder Bay. We would automatically, we had a sampling system set up on the belt as it was unloaded. Sampling devices would take a representative sample from usually about roughly a kilogram from each boxcar.
And loading, I suppose.
Yeah.
To assure yourself, first of all, that it was a homogeneous.
Right. As it's unloaded, it's unloaded into a pit. And then when they decide which bin they're going to put it into, they release it from the pit onto a belt, and we sample it from the belt.
Right.
And so for the amount of time it takes for it to run out, is the sample we're going to be getting.
So if we were to go back to that country point for a moment, when the agent is sampling, and I guess he himself, I guess they'd all be men in those days, would have the have to have the knowledge of the quality of each farmer's load, because he would be dumping, depending on quality, into different bins in the elevator, wouldn't he? Because you'd want the Mokhtar, when it came in, to be number one or number two or whatever it was throughout, no matter where that grain had been loaded.
The Canadian Wheat Board would put out a call to the particular country elevator to load X number of cars for Thunder Bay in particular grade. So the elevator manager would have to be aware of what particular grade he would be calling for from the farmer if he didn't already have it in his stock.
Yes.
And for a particular type of grain to be sent to Thunder Bay in order for it to be here in time for the vessels to load. While we're talking about that, I will make a significant change that's happened here is that when we used to ship to Russia, we would just ship. There would be no, they would call for X number of millions of tons at the beginning of the year. Since we've lost them, we have now come up with roughly 70 different customers that we ship grain to. And because of the world economic crunch over the years, some of these countries can't take the grain until they can pay for it. And sometimes that involves, like, we have to get the grain from wherever we're going to ship it from here and ship to that country within a month. And then when the boat gets there, wait till the check clears the bank, more or less, until we unload it. So it's really changed a lot that way. So marketing-wise, Canadian Wheat Board is a huge advantage for us nowadays, I think, for the farmer.
So the Canadian Wheat Board will be, and so the skipper, the crew of the Salty waits there until they're told to unload it.
Yeah, they're given direction when to load it and when to unload it. If they're here too early, they just wait until they're assigned the time to pick the grain up. And they pick the grain up, they deliver it, and they have to wait basically until the country can take receipt of it or until their company releases it.
So that's one of the reasons that the Salty may sit in harbor for a day or two, whereas the Lakers are just moving it down the system, I guess, and they arrive, the Lakers, they pull in, they get loaded, and it's sent off.
The Lakers are taking the Lakers, which we have fewer of every year, are basically transferring it to another elevator for further pickup down the end of the St. Lawrence, Quebec City, Montreal, Port Cartier, Baie-Comeau. Yeah. Those are all points that we ship domestically to moderate areas like that to take the particular grain and use it in that area.
Yes.
If it's going to be held in a transfer elevator, we ship it by Laker. Salties that come here to pick up grain for direct export can arrive here early, can be here a week early, can be here and the grain isn't here, and we find them waiting out. Demurrage charges can occur if they are here on time and the grain isn't here on time. So you're looking at roughly to have a Salty sitting in the harbor. You see a lot more of that in Vancouver than you do here because they only have so many plants there to load the grain, and Salties come in and because of the different factors involved weather-wise, shipping through Rogers Pass, et cetera, can cost Canadian government a lot of money in demurrage charges. Demurrage can run up to about $25,000 a day for a Salty to sit waiting on top of what their charter is.
These are expenses for the Canadian Wheat Board as
they have to pay,
owners of the early charged against their returns. To return to the matter of the sampling, then, so it's sampled as it comes off the out of the car into the elevator. How many more times then is it sampled inside the terminal elevator?
The sample then we take to the elevator company takes a sample for their own records to in case they have a request to have somebody within their own organization look at it further if they have a complaint. We take a sample and we process it further for many different criteria. Some of the criteria that I can give you would be moisture test, make sure that the grain is not overly wet or damp. It has to be furtherly dried in Thunder Bay because there's a charge occurred to that. We sample it for bugs. So we take another sample from that. We send it to our entomology lab and they check for insects and other infestation. And if we think that on perusal by the inspector, if we think there's anything that looks like it might have any kind of insects or anything to that effect in it, we ask the elevator company to hold it in a separate bin until further review downtown or our central office. We also check it for protein level if it is a wheat and durum, because we bin those very specifically according to the level of protein in the wheat. So there's different processes for taking from the main sample little samples for other purposes.
This is all on the way to storing it appropriately in,
yes,
in preparation for the shipping.
Yeah.
And so then the third sampling would occur in the loading of the ship then, or are there other steps?
Then we also sample it, yes, like you said, as we load it out, we keep a big sample for that. We may also at that time, so the elevator company may come to us and ask us for a sample, and we will process a sample for them. So it can also be, if they think that there is a problem, it can also be sampled wherever it is unloaded, whatever foreign port. And that has happened quite frequently in the last little while because of different concerns by different countries from previous shipments have led them to have a little less distrust in our system. So that's a new...
The sense that the layperson who has some knowledge of the industry or wheat growing in Canada, particularly of wheat, is that quality is very, very important to the Canadian industry. Grains of a particular protein value. In fact, I gather that visual identification is one of the features that seeds have to meet, that the grain is harvested out there in the field, you need to...
Because they're moving away from actual visual identification of the grain varieties. There, it's more to a process where the companies or the end user requires a certain specific level of protein, moisture, whatever they want it for. So we're now producing particular wheats and barleys, etc., end use mostly. They've developed different machines which they haven't perfected yet for what we call black box identification, where you can put the grain in there, it's like a whole grain analyzer, and it will tell you what it is. And so they're getting away from the actual visual identification process. There are things now that are so hard for the human eye to detect that only either a chemical process, electronic process can identify those things. And so it's getting quite technical.
Are there any particular places where this research to achieve this kind of inspection is taking place?
All around the world. In fact, we have right now, the latest occurrence is that all our flax out of Thunder Bay, that we had 850,000 metric tons that was going to be shipped out of Thunder Bay to Europe, is now been stopped because the European Union has decided that they found what they believe to be a genetically modified or altered ingredient in the flax has stopped. In fact, Germany discovered it.
Yes.
Until the further process is done. So now what we have had to do is we've had to divert shipments of grain of flax here to British Columbia, so it goes out the West Coast. Say. Last year that happened with our canola. They found genetically altered canola mixed in with some of our canola. And so we couldn't detect that through visual inspection. That has to be done.
No.
End use by, usually by the company that's receiving the product,
yeah,
have enough technical expertise to be able to see what they're looking for, and if they see something they don't want, they'll reveal it at that time.
I don't know how much discussion has there been in regard to this flax matter and how the adulteration may have occurred. I've seen a newspaper story or two that I found rather shocking in its way, but the central feature being the plant scientist at the University of Saskatchewan. Now, I didn't go down to the basement to check my library, but I think I have a book by him on modification of grains, this kind of genetic experimentation. But the part that astounded me was that he achieved this. It was a matter of producing a flax that would be able to handle sprays, so it's herbicide, not immune, but resistant, herbicide-resistant flax that he had produced. And I gather that he gave samples of this, handed them out to people, which strikes me as incredibly irresponsible, given what the world thinks, or what Europeans particularly think about genetic modification. I don't know, do you have any further comment
on that?
Well,
sure, definitely.
It's in a way that you can talk about that.
Yeah, definitely. It's, over the years, you know, you wonder sometimes whether scientists or even farmers, what they're thinking of doing. I've worked in the trade here for so many years where a farmer, most of the seed that you plant into the ground has been treated with mercury in order for it to get through the germination stage. Yeah. Insects don't attack it. So all that seed has got a mercury component to it. And so some farmers have got all the seed left after they plant. They throw it in with their product. Yeah. Yeah. And so we get it here, and we've got a boxcar full of grain or a tanker full of grain. It's got mercury kernels in it. And so the only way you can get in there is through poor handling or inept handling. And it makes you wonder that, are they thinking when they're doing these things? Is the scientist thinking when he gives samples of this? He may have done it out of goodwill, thinking that this, you know, is something that is going to be beneficial because it allowed the flaxseed to grow and not be affected again by... Yes. So they're getting away from using mercury. They're using strain-resistant, genetically altered seed in order for it to come through, you know, the process without using mercury compounds, etc. So the whole process behind it, I think, is a good idea, but the end result is what scares people. And, you know, when you say genetically altered, that just scares people and scares, you know.
Well, the canola instance has involved the lawsuit that is Mr. Schmeiser, the farmer, who was accused of planting genetically modified when I think his business was organic farming, as he best he could do it. And so he was certainly, and the company sued him for using their seeds without paying them, when it would seem that, in fact, it had been intrusion into his fields from neighboring fields. And that, of course, is the worst part of this genetic modification. It's like Pandora's box. You open it, the stuff begins to spread. It spreads quite naturally. And I guess, well, this obviously impacts your work. This isn't
it? Does it? Huge impact on a lot of jobs, and not only that, but the reputation of the Canadian grain industry is at risk when that happens, because people are fearful if this gets by the system, which is supposed to be so good. Because basically, we sell our grain based on the fact that it is cleaned and guaranteed. Yeah. We can't compete against the United States, Australia, other big countries that produce a way more product than we do, but we can compete because they know that our product is a higher quality and is government backed.
Yes, it makes Canadian grain a little bit, at least I suppose, a niche product, as the jargon of the industry
and more so today than ever before.
Yes. In the case of wheat, which is used in, let's say, in flour production for making bread and other purposes, is it true that countries, the buyers, may end up taking our grain, some of our grain, mixing it with other grains?
Just from the natural fact that our growing conditions here produce a quality that that can't be done anywhere else in the world. We can produce a hard red spring wheat with a protein content of up to 16% or higher. So a country like the United States produces like a winter wheat or a wheat of a softer quality, they'll mix that off with ours, and it ends up, they get a product that generates like a 13% protein level. So they use it to offset some of their poor quality stuff.
How low would the percentage of protein in their wheats be, the winter wheat?
It can be, we have here in Canada, as low as 10%. 10 to 11%, so I can imagine it would be in the 9 to 10%, but it's consistently a bigger volume of the 9 to 10 to 11%.
Yes.
Then we have a bigger volume of the 13% and higher here, right?
Yes.
So genetically, it can be mixed to make their stuff better.
Right. Can you suggest sort of proportions amongst the various grains that flow through Thunder Bay? Would what proportion of it would be wheat over the
It changes
year?
Every year depending on the sales, but characteristically, we've tried to do different products here, end use products, but mostly Most of our product here is either durum wheat, okay, which is used for you know, different forms of spaghetti, pasta, etc. That's a big product through here. Flax is a huge product through here. It was going to Egypt, different countries who would use that for paint, other oils.
Now, really industrial raw materials.
A lot of canola. A lot of canola goes through Thunder Bay. We sell a lot of canola here. We also do a lot of red spring, hard red spring wheat here. And those are the big products. Barley, most of the barley that comes through here goes to the United States. We ship it down to Milwaukee, and it's used for in the beer process down there.
Right.
We do a lot of oats through here, but the oats also goes to the United States. We ship it from Thunder Bay to Duluth, Chicago area, Milwaukee. It's used in the racehorse industry down there, and also for some for health food products like cereals,
right,
etc. We've got some little niches for specialty crops such as human consumption peas. We do some different lentils, but more or less those are the big products through here that are most of the volume are hard red spring wheat, canola, flax, and durum.
Is there specialization on the waterfront in the elevators? Do certain companies tend to lean towards one, or are all the companies prepared to handle whatever of each?
Yeah, because there's so much downsizing that has gone on. So when Viterra bought out, Viterra, one of the bigger companies now, has since in the last little while bought out, changed its name from Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, they bought out United Grain Growers. So they've shut down many of the plants. In fact, Viterra would like to run all of their products out of one plant, which was formerly 7A and 7B, and have nothing else in Thunder Bay. Presently, they have a plant in Curt River, the only United Grain Growers, A, is still open, but they are looking toward, I think, running everything through one plant. Both of these plants that they have now are not running at peak capacity. And so I think that in the very near future, you could see another plant shutting and then running out of one plant there. James, new player on the scene is Mission Terminal. They're the old Saskatchewan 15 plant beside Cargill out in the Chippewa area. And they handle a lot of Canadian wheat board grain. And they handle a lot of it under contract because they underbid all of the other companies here on unloading, storing, cleaning, etc. So they're a non-unionized plant, and they're in fierce competition against all the other countries in order to survive, companies in order to survive and move ahead in the Thunder Bay area. Yeah. Little player like P&H is still there, but they're more or less a self-contained. They own Butterball Turkey, and they more or less use their plant to produce feed, etc., for their turkey production.
Which is where? In Southern Ontario?
Southern Ontario.
I see. I'd not seen much of P&H on the prairies until I was driving from Montana. Suddenly there were this...